This is Crossroads, a Get Religion podcast.
You may have seen the headline in the Washington Post. The United Methodist Church has appointed a transgender deacon. A picture of M. Barclay. She does not identify as any gender, but transgender works as well as any other. But the real trouble here is not so much M. Barclay, but that reference to the United Methodist Church. As far as I know, it's probably not possible within their current state of church law to have done this, but the Washington Post says they have. So where does the truth lie in this question? Greetings and welcome to Crossroads with Terry Mattingly. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in. Terry Mattingly is Senior Fellow for Media and Religion at the King's College in New York City. He's author of the weekly On Religion column for the Universal Syndicate and the book Pop Goes Religion. He's founder and editor of Get Religion. Terry, welcome back.
Glad to be here.
I'm having a hard time believing, given the little that I do know, but I'm fairly certain of it, that church law forbids such things in the United Methodist Church, that this deacon, M. Barclay, was actually appointed or ordained by the United Methodist Church. What's the story here?
Well, as the story in the Washington Post makes clear, they was ordained. And this gets us into all kinds of complexities about United Methodist life, which for me stands for a bigger subject on the religion beat, which is the fact that what churches believe often depends on what zip code you're in. And this is a phenomena that affects Methodists, I think, as much or more than anyone else. Either that, or I just simply know more about it since I've been covering this precise story since the early 1980s and have followed a lot of the battles. But let me answer your question directly. At this point in time, the United Methodist Church has no policy on transgender clergy. So there is simply, at this point, a hole in the law. Now, what they do have is a policy of faithfulness in marriage and celibacy and singleness. And the Washington Post story, to its credit, goes into great detail that at this moment in time, this particular non-binary, non-gendered deacon has no love life. They all but say that. They say she or he is not involved in a romantic relationship and thus was not found to be in violation of the faithfulness in marriage, celibacy, and singleness law. Now, in my post at Get Religion, I noted that it never addresses the issue of whether this person believes in the teachings of the church, since he or she has just taken vows to defend them. So we're now into issues about what is church law, how do you enforce church law, and do vows mean anything in a postmodern age where a person, presumably with DNA or they wouldn't exist, can be non-gendered because that is what is in his or her mind. Well, what's the status of the church's doctrines up there at the moment he/she took the vows? It's a fascinating subject, but it does appear that there is no law against transgendered clergy among United Methodists. Now, needless to say, there is a way better chance of such an ordination occurring in San Francisco or Chicago than in Atlanta or Uganda, shall we put it, or Nigeria or anywhere else in the global South, which is the growing sector of United Methodist life. This gets us into the other subject, which is that in United Methodist polity, ordination is pretty much up to the regional jurisdictions. And since the early 80s, I have been covering the fact that different jurisdictions within the United Methodist Church, all the way down to their annual conferences, which are kind of local regions, and then there are larger regions. Just, I know that's hard for people to picture in their minds, but in the United States, the big jurisdictions are Western, North Central, South Central, Northeastern, and Southeastern in the United Methodist Church. This ordination took place in the North Central region, which is primarily the liberal upper Midwest. This is a rapidly declining sector of the United Methodist Church, but it is larger than the Western jurisdiction, far and away the smallest United Methodist jurisdiction, which has previously made most of the news when it comes to sexuality, and that I was covering all the way back in the early 80s when the Bishop of Denver declared, frankly, "I don't believe my church's teachings on homosexuality or sex outside of marriage, and thus I'm going to ordain an openly gay man," who refused to answer any questions at all about his sex life. Or at least he refused to answer them whenever the question was asked by Methodists. He was extremely candid when asked by the press or anybody else. So this is an old story. I mean, do the math. 1981, 1982. How old were you then?
1982, I was 18 years old.
Okay, well, I imagine a lot of listeners can do the math there on their own ages. I had just moved to Denver, Colorado, as a religion reporter, and it was in my early 30s when I started covering this story, and I'm now 63. So, once again, this has been around for multiple decades. And this same loophole in United Methodist polity continues to be at the root of all of these stories, which is the jurisdictions do the ordaining. Once they've ordained someone, that person is in valid orders, even though it's inaccurate to say they were ordained by the entire United Methodist Church, as if the United Methodist Church had approved that ordination. What happened, kind of like in real estate, is location, location, location. What works in Denver doesn't represent the whole church, but it's valid unless the whole church then votes to declare it invalid. And that's where the United Methodists have never really succeeded in taking action to defend their own doctrines. Now, at the same time, they haven't changed their doctrines. They've stated over and over and over what the church believes on sexuality and continue to restate traditional basic Christian teachings on this subject. The jurisdictions, the leaders of the jurisdictions, and frankly, a lot of their ecclesiastical bureaucrats and maybe seminary professors, at best are affirming those teachings with their fingers crossed.
Okay, a couple issues here. Obviously, this is a story that would require nuance, somewhat sophisticated understanding of the United Methodist Church and its law and its system
yep.
of polity. And it's going to require that, well, let's deal with the basic grammar first. It's going to require that the story be written with the proper pronouns. You've already stumbled over it. I, as a matter of principle, refer to people by the pronouns.
By their DNA, yeah.
Yeah, by their DNA pronouns as a matter of principle. Of course, I'm not a journalist either. Can you talk briefly about the quandary that a journalist may find themselves in when someone, in this case, M. Barclay, insists on being referred to by the pronoun they rather than he or she in the third person? And what a journalist is to do here?
Well, I kind of, with tongue slightly in cheek, left that subject aside in my post, with the possible exception of one sentence, which several readers, you know, let me know they noted. I did write a sentence that said, as you would expect, the Post story does a great job of telling M. Barclay's story from M. Barclay's point of view and that of M. Barclay's supporters. In other words, I just left the pronoun completely out by repeating the person's name over and over and over. That, frankly, is an option. I'll never forget years ago when I wrote a story about some deaths in a family back early in the AIDS era, in which I was writing a story under Associated Press style, obviously, in which I had six family members in the same story, all with the same last name, which put me in, you know, a tremendously difficult situation under AP style, where you identify people by their last name. You know, I had to go with the younger, the older, and then I had to use pronouns wherever possible. And on one or two occasions, just to be clear, I had to use someone's whole name just to make sure that people understood. I think journalists in this case, I would argue that they need to err on the side of clarity to the reader. And in this case, rather than the awkward situation of singular they, if pressed on this, if I was still in a hard news position, I think I would go for he, she, before I would do a plural singular. You know, they is. You know, I mean, I don't think anybody's saying that we're actually dealing with multiple personality possession or anything here.
Well, let me play devil's advocate for a moment, because someone, I can see an editor, I can imagine, and I don't think I am out of the realm of possibility in imagining an editor saying, you can't use he slash she because that is binary. And the presuppositions of M. Barclay is that she is neither, therefore she can't be kind of that binary he-she.
Or, I mean, I don't fully understand what's really even being claimed here, whether we're talking about essentially a gay person who wants to be bisexual in conduct or something. But clearly this is very much like the whole gender debate. The overarching principle here is that a person is whoever that person claims to be, even at any particular moment in time. And there's a whole, you know, you get the LGBTQIA. I mean, you've got the long list of initials now growing in the sexuality gender catch logo, so to speak. You know, I would be the first to admit I don't understand it all. I do know that when you write a sentence, you need to communicate things in words that readers will have a chance to understand. And in this case, maybe the only solution is to avoid pronouns altogether.
Okay. I guess that raises a question, because the presupposition here that you just mentioned, that a person is whatever they identify as at the moment, raises a question for me with respect to this story. Does this jurisdiction of the United Methodist Church, do they know whom they have consecrated a deacon? In other words, if the gender, the self-identification can change at a moment's notice, they don't really know who or what they've consecrated, do they? They can't tell for sure. She might change her mind.
Well, there you went again with the pronoun. But see, clearly the Northern Central Jurisdiction of the United Methodist Church has said, we are comfortable with this person's beliefs. And at that point, since we're dealing with at the level of religious belief, you know, I've heard some people say that people have a right to declare their own gender and whatever as a matter of their religious liberty, to be perceived as the soul they are saying they are. I mean, this opens all kinds of doors. My point in the story, and here in what I hope we're talking about today, this affects Methodists. What people, I think, really need to understand is the degree that this affects other churches as well. If you have followed debates, even, say, among Southern Baptists for decades, you'd have to be crazy not to note that it matters what zip code you're in when it comes to what Southern Baptists believe. And occasionally, a local Baptist association will disenfranchise an individual congregation because with their congregational freedom and soul competency, they have taken some action with which they disagree. But the simple fact, even within a state like Texas, which I know so well, Southern Baptist life in Austin is not the same as Southern Baptist life in rural or small town Texas. The more Baptist you have in a zip code, the more likely you are to find people of varying beliefs, and those beliefs are often determined by how far you are from a university campus or kind of the general cultural makeup of wherever you are in terms of city or town. Now, this would even affect, I've watched Mormon debates in recent years, and you'd be crazy not to note that there are geographical patterns. In the Roman Catholic Church right now, we actually have in a recent papal document on the subject of divorce and the receiving of communion for Catholics who have been divorced but then have not received permission from the church to move on from that and to have that previous marriage nullified, we actually are now beginning to see indications from this particular pope, Pope Francis, that he's comfortable with saying that bishops in Argentina may take a completely different stance on this than bishops in Nigeria versus bishops in Germany versus bishops in Texas, to where they need a kind of zip code regional freedom to adapt doctrine to their own local circumstances, to where the Roman Catholic Church, which to me is kind of the epitome of an ecclesiastical institution that strives for legal and doctrinal consistency, we literally could have the Roman Catholic Church opening itself up on some doctrinal issues to the kind of multi-jurisdictional haziness and fogginess that we see in this United Methodist decision. And I predict that when that happens, what's already happening will get even louder. You'll have conservative Catholics in a certain part of the world saying, wait a minute, this is what our church has taught for centuries. This is what the Bible states. How can we change that? And someone will say, no, we're not changing it. We're just taking some pastoral flexibility. And I would argue that this is all essentially about where people live, the cultures they're in, and that this is a factor in religion news that reporters simply have to start wising up on and covering it. So when the Washington Post prints a headline that says the United Methodist Church has appointed a transgender deacon, some editor somewhere has to be able to say, that's simply factually inaccurate if we're going to actually tell readers what happened. You'd have to say something like United Methodists in American Northeast or United Methodist in urban Chicago or United Methodist in... You're going to have some qualifier that lets the reader know an entire ecclesiastical body has not managed to agree on this sort of issue. Otherwise, we're just confusing people.
With respect to church law, and Methodists are speak of church law. That's how they describe their both their polity, and I think it overlaps with their doctrinal statements as well.
It's the book of discipline is a book both of doctrine and kind of ruling guidelines for community life. Yeah, it's both.
Is there a follow-up story here, not only with the United Methodist Church, but with other churches, where obviously, I've spoken recently with Mark Tooley, who's concerned about this, writing for the Institute on Religion and Democracy about this situation with M. Barclay. And he said, well, I was warning about this and submitting overtures to my regional jurisdiction 10 years ago, and no one took me seriously. And perhaps they will take those overtures seriously now. How do you follow up in a story saying, what is the United Methodist Church, that is the larger organization, which is, by the way, a multinational church?
Yes.
What are they going to do to be proactive in church law to deal with incidents like this?
Well, I'm sure that someone now is going to come forward with some kind of a statement for the discipline related to gender. I can imagine that that will come up. But if I was a reporter and I was at a large paper that wanted to focus, or a wire service that wanted to focus on this, I would immediately contact the ordination councils of the other jurisdictions, at the very least in the United States, and say, what are you articulating at your level about the role of gender since law doesn't address it? Since you lack church law, what is the actual policy on the ground in the massive southeastern U.S. jurisdiction? What's the policy in San Francisco? What's the policy in Denver? Normally what happens in liberal mainline Protestantism is activists on the left act now and argue later. I mean, you saw this years ago, decades ago, with the ordination of women in the Episcopal Church, where a couple of bishops, without the permission of their church, just consecrated some priests and in effect said, we disagree with the teachings of our church, but we're bishops. We have the right to ordain who we want to ordain. We do this. And then the whole church gets caught in a rear guard action, trying to define, often in the light of withering mainstream press coverage, declaring them attempting to stomp down this new uprising of doctrinal and soul freedom, or words to that effect. And the church gets caught coming from behind. In this case, United Methodist Polity allows this. And I'm trying to imagine the United Methodist Church trying to set up a global council governing ordination. I don't think they could possibly do that. It would be too big a task. And of course, you also have the irony of this whole situation, which was, John Wesley. The Methodism movement begins both with his tremendous emphasis on piety and Bible study and small groups and all this other stuff, but also with John Wesley bumping up against the Anglican Church in England over issues of, well, why can't I ordain people? Why can't we ordain who we want to ordain, even if they're a little bit too conservative for you? So the freedom of Wesley, which was claimed as a part of kind of an evangelical revival within Anglicanism, the freedom of Wesley in this day and age turns out to help the left. It's a fascinating and deep subject, and one that deserves, reporters just need to sweat the details on this kind of stuff.
One of the details, and I'm not sure if it's in the Washington Post coverage, I don't recall, but the United Methodist Church is one of the larger of the Seven Sisters, and remains that way because it's multinational. But its website has a news and media section. There is a press section there. They do mm-hmm. have news releases. Is that a place to go, if not to the website, but then to the national organization seeking some kind of clarification statements on stories like M. Barclay?
You could, but I don't think settling for PR statements is a sign of journalism commitment on these things. All of these jurisdictions have their main offices online. It would take maybe 10 minutes to find out some contacts at the jurisdictional level in other parts of the country and to start placing some telephone calls. In the age of the internet, that kind of information is infinitely more accessible. The problem, again, and one that we discuss so often here on Crossroads, is that you have to know what you don't know, or you have to know that a subject exists in order to pursue it. So you have an activist for M. Barclay and M. Barclay's supporters on the telephone talking to you, and they're telling you that, yes, this is perfectly legal, yes, the Northern, and this means it stands for the whole church. And you're going, well, okay. Especially if you're inclined to believe what they're saying because you support that particular issue. But if you don't have any experience covering United Methodist, whether you're liberal, conservative, whatever, you don't know that there are questions to ask. you don't know that there have been papers dating all the way back to a wonderful document, which I wish was online. I still have a hard copy from the 80s called The Seven Churches of United Methodism. And it was written in part by a famous author, William Willimon, who at that time was on the faculty at Duke and is now a United Methodist bishop. I don't know if he's retired or not at this stage. But along with a sociologist, they produced this document in the 80s. I stress, in the 80s, which basically said that United Methodists living in seven different regions essentially went to different schools, believed different things, and in some cases could literally be stated as worshiping different gods in terms of how they defined certain elements of Christology. In some cases, I would say neo-paganism, you know, or whatever. I mean, you had certain trends in the New Age movement and stuff that affected. I covered an Episcopal church service back in the early 90s, you know, where they sang praises to Ra and Ashra, the gods of Egypt, and, you know, and prayed in the name of African deities from a pantheistic order. And the preacher in the service was Carl Sagan, the late Carl Sagan. Now, would you say that that's more likely to happen in a cathedral in New York City than Dallas?
Probably 5 times more likely, yes.
More like 100 times more likely. But yeah, we can argue percentages later. But my point here is location, location, location is something that we have to write into our stories so that readers know that it's not an entire religious body who has reclaimed this. I mean, you can make a story sound bigger than it is. The M. Barclay story is important, but it's just the opening act of what I predict will be a long, long drama. Will readers have a chance to read about all those other acts, or from the viewpoint of the Washington Post story, is this essentially over?
Is a more general and bigger story also, and you hinted at this at the beginning of our conversation, someone actually sitting down and saying, let's go perhaps denomination by denomination. What does the Episcopal Church look like in New York City? What does it look like in Omaha? Doing that compare and contrast, what does the Southern Baptist Church look like in, say, Los Angeles? What does it look like in Oklahoma City?
Mm-hmm.
Talking about those regional differences where you might even be, as you said before, in some cases, talking about essentially different churches under one umbrella.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I can think of hundreds of story angles. Why does this Catholic college produce 10, 15 priests every year, and this Catholic college hasn't produced one in a decade? Why does this Southern Baptist Church give X amount of money to foreign missions and this other one doesn't? Why are Catholic schools closing in certain parts of the church and they can't build them fast enough in others? You've heard the old statement that demographics is destiny. I would say that doctrine is destiny. And then you add a third layer, which is sometimes zip code is destiny on some of these issues. There, you literally, almost every single major story that comes up gets affected by these factors to some degree, whether it's just simply matters of where churches are growing and where they're shrinking. Where are there more nuns, the religiously unaffiliated, not the N-U-N-S of the previous example? Why are there more nuns in the Pacific Northwest than there are in Texas? Why are, the big story you've heard me talk about over and over, why are people lining up to go to confession in certain parishes or in certain dioceses, and yet in other dioceses, the priest maybe hears a couple of confessions a week by appointment, and other than that, that crucial Catholic sacrament has vanished. It's a matter of location, and it's a matter of the functioning religious doctrines in those different locations. And like I said, it's a factor that affects way more stories than we want to admit or that we take the time and trouble to explain to readers.
Terry Mattingly, Senior Fellow for Media and Religion at the King's College in New York City and author of the weekly On Religion column for the Universal Syndicate and the book Pop Goes Religion. He's founder and editor of Get Religion. Terry, thank you for being our guest.
Glad to be here again.
I'm Todd Wilkin. I'll talk with you next week. Thanks for listening to Crossroads with Terry Mattingly.
Crossroads is a joint production of GetReligion.org and Issues Etc.